Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Raymond Tongakar. The U.S. ranks as one of the most religious nations among industrialized countries, but that may be changing. A Pew survey released last October showed that one-fifth of American adults say they don't identify with any religion. Among young people under 30, nearly a third say they are religiously unaffiliated, and these numbers appear to be on the rise. So what's going on here? Is this evidence that America is becoming a secular nation, or is this simply a temporary trend? Today on Intersection, we'll take a look at the rise of the religiously unaffiliated. Joining me in studio, Deborah Mason is the director of the Center on Religion and the Professions. She's also the publisher of the Religion News Service. That's an internationally distributed non-sectarian wire service that covers religion. Deborah, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Richard Chip Callahan is the chair of the MU Department of Religious Studies. Chip, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
And Reverend Molly Hausch Gordon is the minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Columbia. Thanks for joining us today, Molly.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone at some point, we'll bring in later on, is Kimberly Winston. She's a national correspondent for the Religion News Service, where she covers atheism, humanism, and other forms of non-belief. And we'd like to hear from you in the audience as well. Do you consider yourself spiritual but not religious? Why or why not? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. Well, to start out, who are the religiously unaffiliated? Are they just all atheists or agnostics? Deborah, do you want to take that?
Sure. I think one of the misconceptions of that particular survey is that people assume that that means that people have no spiritual faith or no religious ideas or no, you know, other kind of religious beliefs. And really, that number is kind of a complicated number. What we do see is a trend away from institutionalized religion, and so that's what's reflected in that number. So you have people who maybe are spiritual seekers. That's been a growing trend for the last few decades. You have people who perhaps worship at home. You know, maybe they meditate at home. Maybe they read some kind of sacred scriptures, but they don't attend any kind of other organized institutional kind of faith. And then you do have people who are, you know, actual atheists, people who reject any kind of institutional religion or institutionalized belief in a deity or other kind of spiritual tradition.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like a pretty broad group of people.
Right.
Molly, could you talk about some, so I would imagine that you've spoken to a wide variety of people in the Universalist Unitarian Church. What have you been hearing?
Yeah, we have quite the wide variety of folks in our congregation, and a lot of the kinds of people that Deborah has just named, those who are looking for community often find us as a sort of pluralistic, seeking sort of tradition. So we do have people in our congregation who are atheists, agnostics, seekers, and people who subscribe to various faith traditions. And I think what we're hearing a lot from them is that some of the trappings of institution, of the faiths that they came from, just really didn't fit with their values and really sometimes didn't fit with what they thought their faith tradition proclaimed, that maybe they felt like their tradition might not have been walking the talk And so, you know, they're looking for a way to have that spiritual exploration that fits their values.
Okay, well, we have Kimberly on the line now. Kimberly, are you there?
I'm here.
Great, well, thank you so much for joining our show.
Thank you.
Kimberly, would you mind telling us about how does this group break down in terms of demographic factors, maybe like education or geography?
Well, it's huge. It breaks down, it's something like 46 million people. They're all over the United States. The majority of them are under the age of 30. The majority of them are male. The majority of them are white, Democratic. But what's really important to remember is that, as Deborah said, just because they are not religiously affiliated does not mean that they have no religious / spiritual beliefs. In fact, the majority of them do believe in some form of God or universal spirit.
Okay, and you've been covering this for RNS for about 2 years now. What have you been hearing? Are there stories that you can tell that kind of illustrate the complexity of this group in terms of how it breaks down?
Well, one thing I love about my job is that this particular beat has been, every day, it's been a surprise. You know, the minute I think I have it nailed down, what a non-believer is, the minute I'm completely surprised. It's really everything. It's everything from the person who says, I absolutely do not believe in God or any supernatural thing, to people who say, I believe in something bigger than myself, but I don't know what that is. And it's everything from folks who would not set foot in a church to people who identify as I have no religious beliefs, and they're starting to form their own Sunday morning communities that look a lot like church. Another thing I've been surprised about, but the Pew study bore out, is it is a lot of young people, and their non-religious beliefs are very strong. They don't seem to be so much questioning as being certain.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the idea that there are a large portion of this group are young people, isn't that a typical part of youth, just this type of questioning? I guess what I'm trying to ask is this a surprising trend? Also, is this a trend that's likely to continue?
Well, I think it is part of being young that you do question what you believe. But I think what's different here from previous generations is that, as I said, these folks seem really, really certain to me. I hesitate to paint anything with a super broad paintbrush. There is someone that I covered recently who was committed in her atheism, woke up one morning, and decided to convert to Catholicism. I mean, it is all over the place. But I really do think that part of this trend is also that this generation, more than previous generations, really distrusts authority, really distrusts organized anything, and are looking to create their own organizations and look inside themselves or to their peers for authority, for spirituality. So they just are not going to be coming back to these churches.
Okay.
They've never been in the churches, and they're not going to come back to the churches.
And I do want to explore this distrust of authority, but I'm also curious as to when this began. Chip, do you want to weigh in on that?
That's a hard question to answer.
Sure.
In some ways, I think you can think about Protestantism itself, which is the dominant form of religion in America, as this is kind of it makes sense. This trend makes sense according to the logic of Protestantism, which from the very beginning questioned the authority of the church, the Catholic Church at the time, and put a lot of weight of authority on the believer, on the individual. And one way to think about this trend over time is more and more focus on the individual and the individual's ability to make up for their own mind what they think is true, and to question everything that that others might tell them. So in some ways, it's a logical consequence of Protestantism. Within the United States, you've had various times when you've had large movements like this. You can look at the Church of Latter-day Saints in some respect. Joseph Smith sort of wondering in the midst of the Great Awakening in 1820, what church should I join? What denomination is true? He asked God, and God said none of them. So he went off and founded his own. Through the mid-19th century, you had the rise of spiritualism. A lot of people that were members of churches but on the side were also practicing spiritualism, having seances, contacting the dead. But here was an example of maybe people are members of churches because churches are part of their community, part of their social structure, but their religious activity and belief is coming from elsewhere, not from their churches. You have the New Thought movement in the late 19th century, the power of positive thinking in the early 20th. Again, people in churches, but getting a lot of their understanding about what we might call religion, about the nature of reality and stuff like this from elsewhere, from popular culture in many respects. And then more recently, you're getting, and people have been sort of following this idea of people who are religiously unaffiliated since at least the 80s, when you had famous book, so group of sociologists headed by Robert Bella wrote a book called Habits of the Heart, where one of the chapters talked about a woman who they called Sheila, who said, my religion is just my own beliefs, what I know to be true. And they called her religion Sheilaism and said, it's on the rise. It's an example of sort of the trend of toward individualism and privatization of religion, that an individual can come up with their own ideas. And so that was in the 80s, and they saw that kind of increasing. And you get this kind of focus on that, the seeker, we've called it, but also people that just, even if they do belong to churches, might think my understanding of whether or not this church is correct or not is coming from my own understanding, my own self, my own thoughts. So the church itself isn't really necessarily the center, the focus, the final authority of what they believe. So leaving the church when they don't think that it's correct would be an example of this kind of, I'm not fully affiliated with that church, I'm affiliated with myself. Now, whether that's a good thing or not, it's been something that a lot of people have debated since the 80s anyway, is this kind of privatization, this kind of individualization of religion, a bad thing? Does it take away from community, et cetera? And I think that's a much more complicated issue that has to do with other factors in the changing structures of society and culture in America.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to explore the implications of this, but I just want to remind listeners right now that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tungekar. Today, we're talking about the rise of the religiously unaffiliated, those that identify as not having a religion. Joining me in studio are Deborah Mason. She's the director of the Center on Religion and the Professions. She's also the publisher of the Religion News Service. Richard Chip Callahan is the chair of the MU Department of Religious Studies, and Reverend Molly Hausch Gordon is the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Columbia. And joining my phone is Kimberly Winston. She's a national correspondent for the Religion News Service. And for you in our audience, do you consider yourself a religious person? What sustains your faith? Please share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you that you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. There you can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. Well, why are we seeing this trend now? What is it in response to, if anything? Do you want to take that, Deborah?
Boy, if I had that answer, I could write a great book, couldn't I? I think there are a lot of complicated reasons. I mean, Chip can talk about, secularization theory and, the idea that as cultures become more knowledgeable, more have more information about science and so on, that they rely less and less on spiritual matters to answer some of their questions about life, and that's sort of a trajectory. I probably just really massacred that, but at any rate, that's kind of a trajectory for developed nations, and we've seen that in Europe, for instance, where you have a lot of gorgeous, beautiful cathedrals and churches that are barely have hardly any people in them, other than tourists. I did see a lot of tourists in churches in France recently, but. So some people would say, would argue that this is something that comes along with the modern era, in essence. There was a study recently that talked about changes in, for instance, blue laws, which used to prohibit stores and other businesses from being open on Sundays. And now, for instance, I have a daughter who takes gymnastics lessons, and she has a practice on a Sunday afternoon. That was something that you didn't see, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and certainly not 50 or 80 years ago. So changes like that that make it easier and give more incentive for people not to be in their houses of worship is certainly one thing. Another thing is that we are becoming a more pluralistic society, a more culture, and we're exposed to more religious views, and that can sometimes lead to questions and to wondering if our faith perspectives are, you know, are the right ones for us. People, what we do know from studies is that people are far less likely to, if they are practicing a faith, belong to the same faith tradition they were raised in. That's been a trend that's been going on and has been increasing.
Hmm. And so how does it work with unaffiliated households? Do children of parents that are unaffiliated grow up to seek a religion typically?
You know, I don't know that we really have that much data on that, to be quite frank. I mean, you know, I would say that the data that we have on truly couples that, you know, have no religious affiliation and how they're raising their children, I frankly don't know of any large-scale studies on that. I don't, maybe you do. I just don't think they exist. That's a very hard thing to kind of study. It's hard to find those people in the first place. And but what we do know is that there are a number of different trends. You know, more people marry different faiths. You know, I mean, when my mother-in-law wanted to marry, she was Roman Catholic, wanted to marry a Lutheran man, her parents forbade it. So, you know, now nobody thinks twice usually of a Catholic marrying a Protestant or you know, most Jews, in fact, intermarry and don't marry other Jews in the United States. So, you know, you have intermarriage, you have other kinds of things like this that are in which people are being exposed to lots of different religious views and not necessarily staying in one place where they would always go to the same congregation and be raised in that congregation, and their grandparents went there and their parents went there and they went there and their kids went there. That's a very rare occasion anymore.
Okay. Well, Kimberly, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Earlier, you had alluded to the idea that young people might be distrustful of institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate on that? Why is that the case, and when did that begin?
Well, I can tell you from my own life, sure. Watergate. I mean, you remember that set off a whole generation of us suddenly distrusting our government in a way that we perhaps had not distrusted them before. But I think that if we're talking about the young people who are under 30 who identify as nuns, I mean, think about some of the scandals that we've seen in organized religion since they were born, maybe in the 80s. We have, you know, the Jim Baker scandals. We have, just recently with the Catholic Church, I know that in the Pew study that we're talking about, one of the things that they asked folks, what keeps you out of the pews? And among those who were not religiously affiliated, one of the things was that they felt there was a lot of hypocrisy in the churches. And you know, I hear from young people on my beat that if they did grow up in a church, and by church I mean any organized religion, and they're hearing, you know, those people over there are going to go to hell because they don't think like us, or those people are bad people because they don't believe in Jesus. But as Deborah was saying, we're a very, very diverse society now, much more diverse than we were in the 1960s. And so now those kids can look at, say, well, wait a minute, my neighbor is a Sikh gentleman, and he doesn't beat his kids, and he pays his taxes, and he mows his lawn. Why is he going to hell? Why are you telling me he's going to hell? And they start asking questions. And one thing you and I discussed was that this generation also has had access to the internet in a way certainly the previous generations did not. And, you know, it used to be that when you had a question about, what do you mean my neighbor's going to hell, you could go to your parents or your pastor. And now these people go online and they find out that there's a whole huge community out there of other people who are not religiously affiliated or other people who might think the way they do. And so they don't have to go to church for their answers anymore. They don't have to go to church for their community anymore. And they don't have to go to church to find validation for their own spiritual religious beliefs or moral beliefs. They can find that community online. And so why would they go back into the church?
And is that what you're seeing, Molly, as well, among the people you've been speaking with, that they're also finding their own communities online and seeking, I guess, various options through the internet?
I mean, I'm sure that there's some of that. I mean, there's just so much out there. I do think that, I mean, I am a part of this generation. I'm just barely under 30 myself. And so I sort of speak from that experience. And I think that there is that sense that you can get some of the information you need. Maybe there is that sense that Chip mentioned of sort of this hyper-individualism, but I actually also sense a sort of hunger for authentic community. And it's true that church isn't at the top of the mind when it comes to thinking about that kind of community. I think that a lot of young people are finding different ways of creating community, you know, food co-ops or, you know, intentional living community gardens are some of the things that I've seen happening. I'm sure lots of other different things that aren't in that same vein. But I actually think that this creates a real opportunity for churches who can and are in the practice of, if they're doing things well, creating a community with depth that is hard to find on the internet. That real sense of personal interaction and connection. And I think my generation is hungry for that in a world that has, for so many years, had this hyper-individualized, sort of fragmented way of being and sort of more and more fragmented. And I think that if we can create really authentic communities that aren't sort of the hypocritical kinds of being that that put up people's suspicions, you know, if we can be really authentic communities, that I think that is what young people are looking for, and could be a real balm to a society that has become sort of fragmented by the breadth of the internet. You know, you can go out and get anything, but is it deep and is it good? And is it real connection? And I think that that's something that the churches who are going to survive are going to be looking to create.
Chip, I saw you nodding your head earlier. Was there anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, your mention of food co-ops or that kind of thing. Back in the 90s, Princeton sociologist Robert Wuthnow was studying small groups and seeing them as the place where people are getting their sense of community, their sense of identity, their spiritual fulfillment, and everything from, you know, you might think Bible study groups or something, and that was part of it, but also Alcoholics Anonymous, sports teams, book clubs, and people are, you know, they may be a member of several of them, and they may be members of them for a long time and not identify fully with one or the other, but through those, they are developing a depth of community, and those are the people that might be nuns, right? I mean, they may or may not belong to a church, but a church is not the only place to find your community or even your spiritual community. And that's linked to this idea of individualism. I want to just emphasize, I didn't mean that as a negative, which is a lot of people do, but to be an individual and to sort of be able to create your communities yourself and make decisions and choices about your communities isn't to say you don't believe in community. There's a difference between an individual having some agency to choose their forms of community versus someone who just belongs to a community because that's where they were tossed into, that's where they were born, et cetera. So I think this emphasis on individualism isn't just an isolated individual. It's an individualism that also is connected to choosing of a certain form of community and creating a world around them that they desire, as opposed to just what they're given.
Okay. And earlier you'd referred to this group as the nuns. Just to clarify, that's none as none of the above.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we have a caller on the line right now, David from Columbia. Are you there, David?
Yeah, Raymond. How are you, sir?
I'm good. And yourself?
I am excellent. I just want to remind everybody, however, that the nuns also include one of the fastest growing groups, which is the atheist community. And right now, while in the 2010 census, the atheist community represents close to 9% of the populace out there. And we also have a community, and we have meetings, and we have everything that a community needs. We just don't have the dogma that goes with it.
Okay. Would you like to respond to that, Chip or Deborah?
Well, I'll point out, I've got it in front of me here, 12% of the nuns in the Pew survey were identified themselves as atheist. But it's also interesting that a number of those atheists and the agnostics said that they believe in God or some kind of universal being. Also, a number of them, 17% of those who said they were atheist or agnostic, take part in daily, weekly, or monthly prayer. Mm-hmm. What exactly atheist means in this context, just like what nuns means, is unclear.
There's a problem, and you're mixing two groups up. Atheists and agnostics are two different thought processes as to the mythologies of religion.
Right.
A lot of agnostics also believe themselves as deists, which is different than being a theist. So, and a number of us, including myself, I do meditate. I don't necessarily believe in the mythology that goes along with some of the meditation realms out there. So the idea of how this is all being read and interpreted really comes to where it's coming, where who's doing the interpretation. I do want to say one thing, however, and that is the Unitarian Church has to be one of the most welcoming. When I decided to, when I discovered that my true belief was as an atheist, as a non-believer, it was the Unitarians that accepted me before anybody else.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for calling in,
thanks,
David.
I wanted to just bring up something that David did talk about, and that is the creation of organizations and institutions around this diverse group of atheists, free thought, secular humanists, and it is very diverse, and the institutions that are surrounding around them are quite diverse, and they're becoming much more visible. And Kimberly could tell you quite a bit about them. She's attended a lot of their conventions, but there's a growing amount of money that is going toward these organizations from philanthropic atheists and secularists and free thought folks who are wanting to have a higher profile in the public discourse about this country and about the role of religion and the relationship between religion and government.
I can just add on there. Yes, there certainly is a difference between atheists and agnostics. I shouldn't have lumped them together like that. But some of the atheists in the study also did say that they believe in some kind of higher power. But what's also important to take away here is that religion doesn't necessarily just mean belief in God, right? What we're talking about when we're talking about atheists or believers, as the term has come up a few times, is people that believe in God. But there are religions that don't necessarily believe in God. Buddhism, for instance, it's all illusion. So,
I'm sorry, we're about to head to a break right now. I just want to remind listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking about the rise of the religiously unaffiliated. Joining me in studio are Deborah Mason, Director of the Center on Religion and the Professions, Richard Chip Callahan is the chair of the MU Department of Religious Studies, and Reverend Molly House Gordon is the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Columbia. And joining us by phone is Kimberly Winston. She's a national correspondent for the Religion News Service. I'm Raymond Tongakar. We'll be back after a short break. Okay, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tongakar. Today, we're talking about the rise of the religiously unaffiliated, those that identify as not having a religion. Joining me in studio are Deborah Mason, director of the Center on Religion and the Professions. She's also the publisher of the Religion News Service. Richard Chip Callahan is the chair of the MU Department of Religious Studies. And Reverend Molly Hausch Gordon is the minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Columbia. And joining us by phone is Kimberly Winston. She's a national correspondent for the Religion News Service. And for you in our audience, would you vote for someone that's openly identified as having no religion? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia, or you can join our online chat. I'm sorry, Chip, before the break I cut you off, but was there anything else that you wanted to add?
I'm just commenting on religion, whether it has to do religion itself, has to do with belief in God or not. And one thing that was kind of interesting recently, I don't remember exactly when, in the New York Times, there was a story about atheists who pray, not to God, clearly, but who pray. And it makes me think about, in the United States in particular, we like to think about religion, I think because of a sort of Protestant bias in how we think. We think about religion in terms of beliefs, but we might think about religion in terms of practices, what people do. And when we think about religion in terms of practices, praying, for instance, we have a very different picture of what's going on. I mean, atheists who pray, whether or not we call them religious or not, there's a lot at stake for both sides on that. But there's something to these activities of meditation, of prayer, of, well, you name it, of burial, of you know how we memorialize people, that I would say have something to do with the long history of human beings and religion. But wouldn't people can be part of practicing those kinds of things and getting something out of it, whether we call it spiritual or they call it human, whatever, but some kind of something comes out of these practices that are not accounted for in the way that we look at the results of a survey like this. We don't really know. All this tells us is who is aligning themselves with, affiliating themselves with a particular religious institution or tradition. And it doesn't tell us much about those people who are not affiliating themselves, what they are or are not doing or thinking of themselves.
Okay, and I want to go back to an earlier point. Deborah had mentioned the role of atheists and just the organization, the mobilization of atheists. Kimberly, could you talk to us about, could you tell us who the big players are within atheism?
Sure. Now, at the risk of alienating some of my sources, big players is a loaded term.
Sure.
Because there's big in terms of membership, there's big in terms of how loud they are, how aggressive they are. There's American Atheists, which has last April celebrated its 50th anniversary. That is one of the more vociferous, more active organizations. It was one of the main organizations driving last year's Reason Rally in Washington, D.C., which drew record numbers for a non-believer event. There's American Humanist Association. The Secular Coalition for America is a big deal. Everybody should be watching right now. Center for Inquiry, which does things in addition to atheist and non-theistic things, also deals with science and debunking certain things like stuff about vaccines, but it does have a non-religious component to it. And these groups are growing, and one of the more interesting ones to me is Secular Coalition for America, which is an umbrella organization of, I think, about 11 or 14 different non-religious groups like American Atheists and American Humanists and a number of other organizations. But they have organized specifically to bring the secular the needs and wants of secular people, they don't use the term atheist, they don't use the term humanist, to Washington, D.C. And they're growing in number, they're growing in power. In the last year, one of their goals has been to start start a Secular Coalition for America chapter in all 50 states. I'm not sure if they've completed that right now, but, you know, they were getting chapters in all 50 states, and their goal was to teach people who are secularly oriented to lobby on the local level and run for office, groom people to run for office as I am a secular candidate. And they're having some success. They've been able to meet with members of Congress. I think last week they met with President Obama's Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, and that was a huge deal to have the secular group recognized by the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. They were really, really happy about that, and they were very happy about their reception there. But let's keep in mind, let's put this in perspective. I was astonished to learn that American Atheists, who's a group, if I asked, you know, the average Joe on the street to name an atheist organization, that would be the one that they would most likely come up with. And when I asked the president of American Atheist Association on their 50th anniversary how many members there were, dues-paying members, the number was 4,000. So very small, but very committed, and not likely to get smaller, I don't think. I think they will only get bigger as, you know, as this younger generation of nuns begins to organize and join, which is not something a lot of young people do, but you tend to do that as you age.
And so I guess while this isn't I guess earlier you had talked about this distrust of institutions. I guess what among young – how does this – I guess how do these more secular groups kind of evade that label of some kind of institution, or how are they still able to, I guess, mobilize and increase their numbers?
Well, I think that's a big challenge for them. You know, I can only tell you anecdotally some things that I heard that rather surprised me in the course of my reporting in the last couple years. There's a an organization called Secular Student Alliance, which has chapters of secular groups of students on colleges, universities, and high schools all around the country. And their growth has been really fast and really impressive. And, you know, they're kind of – they think they're challenging what is the one for young Christians? It's not Young Christians Associates, Campus Crusade. Campus Crusade for Christ, they think that their numbers are beginning to challenge Campus Crusade for Christ in terms of the number of chapters that they have. And when I talked to some folks who were in these groups in college, and I said, so, you know, now you're going to graduate college, what's next for you? And I had more than three or four of these folks over the course of maybe a year tell me that they had no plans to join local atheist or humanist or non-believer focused groups because they had been to visit them and didn't like what they saw. They felt they were too argumentative, too judgmental, and too white. And this was not what they found on their campus. These SSA chapters often meet with the local Muslim chapter on campus, and they make a point of going to a different religious organization every Sunday. And yet, when these folks moved out into the, you know, the post-college world, if they want to join some of these non-theistic groups, they find them very militaristic, and religion is the enemy. And a lot of these young folks, whether they're non-believers or nuns, do not see religion as the enemy or inherently evil. And so they're not necessarily joining a lot of these groups. And I think that's going to be a hurdle for some of them.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to kind of to what Chip was saying, which was, you know, this idea that it's about belief is not quite right.
Right,
because they're also not joining these organizations that point to non-belief or to different kinds of belief, and that it's there really needs to be for all of us, I think, an institutional transformation towards these truly pluralistic environments, which was one of the things that Kimberly was pointing out, towards the kinds of, you know, practices, whether they're spiritual practices or, you know, the kinds of communities where you can get help to actually live out your values. And I think that's what these young people are looking for. They're not looking for somebody who says, yeah, I believe the same thing as you, great. They're looking for communities where they can, you know, if they're secular communities in schools, they're looking for communities where they can live their ethical values together, not just a community that'll say, you know, go atheists. You know, it's about that desire to really to live out the things that we say we believe or practice.
And are there organizations that have been embracing of that, I guess, pluralistic attitude? I guess, for example, the Unitarian Universalist Church. Have you seen, like, a huge spike in numbers?
We've not seen a huge spike in numbers. We have seen some growth, small growth. Mainline Protestant denominations have seen decline, but we've seen sort of steadiness with maybe a teensy bit of growth. And I think part of that points to this idea of the institutional transformation. You know, we're good on the belief, the plurality of belief. We're good, you know, we tend to match with the spiritual but not religious when it comes to social values, which is another thing that we might end up talking about a little bit. But when it comes to sort of some of the trappings of mainline institution that have become less meaningful to younger people, it's something that I think even we are looking for different ways to try things. You know, how can we create those really authentic communities? How can we get all of the committees out of the way and get to really doing the work of living our values? I think that's a live question for any religious institution right now.
Raymond, are you familiar with the term faithiest?
No, would you mind?
Yeah, this is you're talking about, are there these more pluralistic wanting to work with members of faith communities, people who don't believe? Faithiest is a term that I think came out of the Harvard humanist community, which is very big and very active and, of course, associated with Harvard University. And one of the assistant they have humanist chaplains there. And one of the assistant chaplains is a young man. I think he's all of 24 or 25. His name is Chris Stedman. And he wrote a book last year called Faithiest. And it's a word that's kind of been thrown around by hardline atheists to describe more soft core, shall we say, non-believers who are willing to embrace people in the faith communities. And he's kind of taken this derogatory term and embraced it and said, yes, I am a faithiest. I am a non-believer, but I believe that we're all human beings and we all, you know, want to raise healthy kids and, you know, have a responsible government. And he and a lot of other humanists are building communities where they are in dialogue and cooperation with members of their local faith communities. And I think, personally, as this younger generation comes up, we're going to see more of that. There's now these kind of humanist chaplaincies at a couple of universities. But again, the challenge is, what do you do after you get out of university, right? You know, how do we take this then into the community? And does it become, you know, because a lot of non-believers are scared away by the phrase interfaith. They don't necessarily feel welcome there. And they, you know, I think that interfaith communities will have to do more to reach out to non-believing communities. But I think we're going to see more of that, more of these young non-believers and nuns wanting to work with their religious peers.
Okay. Well, I want to remind listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tungekar. Today, we're talking about the rise of the religiously unaffiliated, those that identify as not having a religion. Joining me in studio are Deborah Mason, director of the Center on Religion and the Professions. She's also the publisher of the Religion News Service. Richard Chip Callahan is the chair of the MU Department of Religious Studies, and Reverend Molly Hausch Gordon is the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Columbia. And joining us by phone is Kimberly Winston. She's a national correspondent for the Religion News Service. And for you and our audience, what could churches do to retain members? Do you have any suggestions? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. Well, that was one example I'm wondering, though, if there are other movements or organizations that are trying to create some kind of secular community with rituals, but without like the religious doctrine. Are there any other examples that?
Yeah, there's a little trend right now that a lot of us reporters are keeping our eyes on. There are atheist churches popping up, and while the people who attend them don't necessarily like the term atheist church, if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it's a duck. And there was one that started in London last year called the Sunday Gathering, and they just opened up last weekend. They started a Sunday Gathering in New York City. There's another atheist congregation in Canada, I think in Calgary, and I visited one in Houston in March, and another one just opened up in Louisiana, and I think there's plans for one in L.A. And they get together in a room. There's a podium. There's a leader. There's a program. There are things we say together, you know, affirmations of belief, if you will, and there is music, and then there is something that looks like a sermon but is, you know, without any kind of doctrine or dogma. It's just trying to find some, shared communal truth and share that with the group. And there's even a coffee hour afterwards, and it looks like church. It is the superficial trappings of church, and these things are growing really fast. The one I visited in Houston was less than 6 months old, and they already had to move once out of their original digs and were looking for an even bigger place at the time I visited them on Palm Sunday.
Wow, that's fascinating. Well, there's a lot we still have yet to cover. I want to move on to the intersection of religion and politics. I've read a number of articles that talked about how people theorized that part of this might be a response to the fact that maybe politics played an increasing role in religion that started in the 80s. Would you mind just talking about that, Deborah? You were nodding your head earlier.
Sure. Well, there were a lot of different things and factors that influenced the increasing role of politics and or increasing role of religion and politics. Primarily, I mean, one of the big factors was the largest Protestant denomination in the country, the Southern Baptist Convention, becoming more increasingly involved in politics when, in the past, they had made, you know, specifically kept out of politics. There were lots of other things that had to do with this, and some individual people like, you know, Jerry Falwell and Moral Majority, and you had, you know, Jesse Jackson running for president, you had Pat Robertson running for president, you had Ronald Reagan as president embracing this, and really the development of it as a strategy to achieve a social agenda, primarily in regard to abortion initially. So as this grew, you saw an increasing alignment of people who maybe formerly had lived in the South and had been Democrats aligning themselves increasingly with the Republican Party on social, moral, cultural issues. That is starting to fall apart, is what we're seeing. And so, you know, it leaves more of these alliances kind of fluid. And so You know, you have people like the Tea Partiers who may or may not be religiously affiliated. A large number of them still, I would say, affiliate predominantly Christian, predominantly evangelical Christian. But you may also find, you know, libertarians and atheists, for instance, may fall into that category. Some atheists also fall into progressive liberal camps as well. So some of these alliances are sort of breaking up a little bit. The social, the culture wars agenda that evangelicals had embraced is viewed in part as seen as in part as failing, particularly obviously in the issue of gay marriage. I think the issue of abortion is it's less clear. But so this all raises, it makes the it allows other groups, smaller groups, to have larger voices in the political realm.
Molly, I'm curious. Are political alliances off-putting to young people who might otherwise be spiritual?
Well, that's certainly what some of the Pew numbers have said. One of the sort of self-reported issues with organized religion has been that perception that religion has been overly involved in politics, and particularly, I think, referring to that that Christian conservative alliance with the political right. I know that we get people in our congregation who have left their faith, perhaps because they didn't accept their sexuality or gender identity, and or because even if they are straight or and gender conforming, who young people these days support marriage equality and LGBTQ equality issues and at huge rates, and that can be a huge stumbling block with some of these faith traditions who have been really actively opposed to those issues for years and years. So that's been a place where we've seen some increase, perhaps instead of decline. In that we have been working as a faith tradition for those equality issues for decades as well. But I think that plays a large part, is that perception that these traditions that have taught people in some way the golden rule to love your neighbor are then being really exclusionary in these social issues. I think that's a problem for young people.
Okay. Well, we have a caller on the line right now. John from Mid-Missouri, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, John, what's your comment?
Well, the commenter from the Religion News Service said that young people who have been in the SSA organizations have not joined atheistic organizations because they found them too argumentative and not wanting to participate in the community. And she gave some anecdotes that she heard of two or three people that said that to her. But I think that the statistics don't back that up. I think the biggest barrier to entering atheist communities after college is the non-acceptance of them in the community, the inability to participate in things. For example, I'm in the medical field. I can't participate in a medical mission without being involved with a church group, which requires me to hold my tongue about certain issues. That to me is the largest barrier, to say that the atheist organizations are argumentative. That's not what's keeping young people from joining them. It's the communities out there and the churches that are out there that are opposed to working with these organizations.
Just speaking anecdotally, I actually heard this from between four and six people over the course of about a year, and by no means is that scientific at all. I was just speaking that
I think that you really liked hearing those people say that, because I think it matters.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call, John.
I think this is a larger question for communities of faith and communities of non-belief these days, is that question of membership. And, you know, I think it remains to be seen as this generation ages, whether this is simply an aspect of youth to not join, or if it is something that is a larger, that sort of reluctance to become a member of an institution, if that is a larger trend, I think remains to be seen. But it's something that certainly our Unitarian Universalist churches are thinking about, something that I think non-believer communities are thinking about, is do we need to re-envision this idea of, you know, joining, signing the book, whatever it is, or do we need to start thinking more about who are we serving and, you know, how are we creating the kinds of communities that people need? So, you know, we'll see how membership shakes out with all of these organizations, I think, as this generation ages.
Okay. Richard?
I find it fascinating what the caller just said, that, I mean, a lot of times, a lot of this discussion, a lot of this survey comes back to institutions, right? Mm-hmm. So you can be atheist, or if you want to call yourself atheist, or non-believer, or just not even think about it whatsoever. Whether or not you join a particular institution is a whole other kind of question. And it's interesting that atheists now want people to join an atheist institution as opposed to just be non-believers, to identify with any particular group whatsoever. One thing that's interesting about this survey is that those nuns, that's a catch-all term, the nuns. They're just the people who did not affiliate with other groups. So it's a humongously diverse group. To say that there is somebody called the nuns, I mean, one thing that we're witnessing right now is the creation of a religious category called the nuns. As more and more journalists write about and talk about the nuns or the religiously unaffiliated, they become something. And people now can read about the nuns or read about the religiously unaffiliated and identify with it and say, that's what I am, which otherwise they just, you know, before that they were just not something. Now they're something. They're a religiously unaffiliated person. So we're witnessing before our very eyes the birth of a religious category, which then, as we're hearing, people are starting to try to institutionalize and join, create membership lists where people can join, sign up here, create an identity. And it perpetuates, back to this question of atheist churches, things like this. Are they religion? Are they churches? That's really not the issue for me. Look at how the way that we even begin to think about identity and religious affiliation or non-affiliation or whatever is in terms of these models of institutional belonging and institutional identity. It just replicates itself.
Okay. Well, we have about a minute left or two, but I just want to get a sense of, so will the political landscape have to adapt in response to this? Is that likely to happen? I mean, I guess it's kind of a broad question, but are we seeing I don't know. Well, I guess maybe an easy way of asking the question is, are there any non-affiliated members of Congress, for example? And are we likely to see one elected anytime soon?
There's one, isn't there, Kimberly?
There's one. Kristen Sinema of Arizona describes herself as a nun. And there was some confusion over what that exactly meant, because she was trying to be, some non-theistic groups were trying to claim her as, quote, a humanist or, quote, an atheist, and she defines herself as a nun. Pete Stark was the only atheist member of Congress, and he lost his last election. So we lost one, we gained one, so to speak. And I know that there are a lot of people who believe there are a lot more non-believers in government, but it's political suicide to come out and say so.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it at that. That's it for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guests, Deborah Mason, who directs the Center on Religion and the Professions, Richard Chip Callahan, who's the chair of the MU Department of Religious Studies, and Reverend Molly Hausch-Gordon, who's the minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Columbia. And joining by phone was Kimberly Winston. She's a national correspondent for the Religion News Service. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Intersection is a production of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today's episode was produced by Janet Saidi and Ruben Stern. Travis McMillan is our technical director, with production assistance from Rachel Gangware. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Raymond Tongakar. Thanks for joining us today.